suspicion, or, for that matter, interest. He called the company and said he'd decided to bring an assistant. Would that be possible? The assistant, he added, would be traveling on a different flight.
But put her ticket on my credit card.
We'll have a taxi waiting for her at the airport, Mr. Trabeau.
Very good. What's the best beach on the island? I mean, numero uno.
Oh, they're all lovely, replied the woman on the other end.
Come on, there must be one special place that knocks your knickers off.
She admitted there was.
Playa Ramera, she said fondly.
Never heard of it. What does that mean in English?
I'm not sure, the woman at the agency lied. It's just a local name. Would you like me to arrange a van to take you there from Havana? You and your assistant?
That would be fabulous, Trabeau said.
He looked forward to cavorting openly with Juveline in Cuba, which the mafia had abandoned when Fidel seized power. The fact that Big Noogie had no eyes or ears there made it a safe zone of betrayal for both pleasure and business. Of the dual schemes that Trabeau was hatching, the beach sand project was less problematic because it was he who controlled all the key information. Big Noogie would have no choice but to take the Sandman's word about his dealings with Cuban officials and the monetary split. The tryst with Juveline would be trickier, Trabeau knew, because he wouldn't be able to supervise her once she returned to Queens after their tropical adventure. One offhanded remark, one careless slip-up, a matchbook from Hotel Nacional falling out of her handbag, for instance, could be fatal for both of them. Based on Juveline's nonchalant reaction to the swollen hickey, Trabeau believed she needed more guidance in the art of discretion. He was right. Yancey dialed Rosa's number, and she picked up on the first ring. She asked if he was finished with the case, really finished, and he said yes.
Then you can come, she told him. Bring a parka.
He didn't have a parka. He also didn't have enough money for a flight to Norway, but he had plastic. The layover in Newark was murder, 6 hours and change. Yancey read a wild Harry Cruise novel about a man who eats a car. After that, he walked to a Hudson's, where he bought fishing magazines and the New York papers. The Daily News featured an update about the case of the Muslim tourist from Brooklyn who'd been killed in South Florida. The widow of Abdul Halim Shamoon said police officials were now classifying her husband's death as a hate crime. A statement issued by Monroe County Sheriff Sonny Summers said that a person of interest had been identified and that a joint city-county task force was combing the islands in search of the individual. The sheriff said he was confident the case would soon be solved. As Yancey read the story, he heard his jaws popping. The news ran a picture of Abdul Halim Shamoon and his family standing in front of an electronics shop. The caption said the store was in Midtown Manhattan on 7th Avenue. In the photo, Shamoon was a smiling young man, unrecognizable from the bloodied corpse on Francis Street in Key West. Yancey counted 5 kids, 3 boys and 2 girls, posed on either side of their father. The children would all be grown now. Shamoon's wife wasn't in the photograph, probably because she was the one who took it. Yancey felt he knew what she looked like. He put down the newspaper and jogged back to the main terminal, where he told a man at the SAS desk that he was canceling his Oslo trip due to a personal emergency. An hour later, the airline brought him his luggage, which he rolled all the way to the Delta counter. There, he purchased a ticket to Miami. After boarding the plane, he called Rosa, not the warmest conversation they'd ever had. She made several strong points, the first being that nobody, including Sheriff Summers, wanted Yancey's assistance in pursuing Benny Krill.
Secondly, Yancey's detective skills, superior as they might be, weren't needed on the Shamoon case because Krill plainly wasn't clever enough to elude the cops for long. Rosa's final point, even more emphatic than the others, was that Yancey seemed to be losing focus of the big picture, meaning their future together as a couple. Yancey pointed out that it was she who'd abruptly quit her job and flown off to Europe alone. Such a move was not, he asserted, an act of unshakable devotion. The discussion grew sharper until a flight attendant told Yancey to turn off his phone because they were third in line for takeoff. He bit off half of an Ambien, yet didn't sleep a wink on the plane. The next day was spent scouring Key West for Benny the Blister, Buck Nance, and Lane Coolman. Yancey located only one black Yukon, occupied by a white Baptist rapper who was in town for a concert benefiting the Pre-Teen Pioneers for Abstinence. The listing agent for the Conk House on Fleming said it had been rented by a talent agency called Platinum Artists, which had paid for a month in advance. The agent was surprised when Yancey informed her that the tenants had already moved out. A text from Mary Mansfield sent him speeding up the overseas highway. "Saw Black Yukon on my way back to Miami, parked at a bar at MM82. But you're in Norway, so never mind." Yancey drove like a berserk person and made it to Isla Morada in less than 2 hours. The bar at mile marker 82 was in a sushi restaurant where his credentials actually carried some weight. The hostess remembered three customers arriving in a black SUV the night before. One of the men, skinny but rough-looking, became belligerent because the restaurant served only beer and wine. The hostess said the loudmouth got wasted on sake and started tossing spring rolls in the air, trying to catch them in his mouth. She said the two other men from the black SUV stuck with Kieran Light and more or less behaved themselves. Yancey asked to see the credit card receipt for their meal. It was signed by Lane Coolman, Buck Nance's agent, manager, asswiper. Yancey figured that Krill, Nance, and Coolman beelined from the sushi joint straight to Miami Beach, but out of diligence he inquired at the nearby Moorings, a secluded spread of resort cottages popular with fashion models, musicians, and actors who don't mind not being recognized. A camera crew was set up on the beach, taping a commercial for a brand of guava-infused vodka. Strung between palm trees was a mesh hammock, upon which lay a young blonde woman wearing sunglasses and a banana-colored bikini. She was clutching the fifth of vodka to her cleavage in such a manner that fake condensation, supplied by a crew member with an eyedropper, dripped from the bottom of the bottle onto her tummy, trickling down the spray-tanned slope into a flawless navel. The journey of each glistening droplet was tracked at gynecological range by a scruffy, sweat-soaked cameraman kneeling in the sand with his Sony. Gawkers snapped pictures with their phones. Unnoticed, Yancey made his way through the shaded property, cottage by cottage. He rapped on the doors, pretending to be looking for a guest named Rosa Campesino. The reactions were mostly genial, until he approached a blue-trimmed villa where a croaky voice from inside told him to get lost. Yancey barged into the villa and right away noticed that Benny Krill had upgraded his weaponry. "I thought you were a knife man, Blister." Krill raised the gun.
"Name Spyro."
"That's a winner. I like it."
"Close the goddamn door."
Yancey said, "Tell me what happened on the conk train."
"He freaked out is what happened. The little Arab dude. I didn't lay a finger on him."
"A couple witnesses say otherwise."
"Bay's full of shit."
Blister took a step back. He looked anxious.
"All I did was tell the man he wasn't fooling nobody. I know a damn sleeper cell when I see one. Then there was some Bible stuff I laid on him, all righteous and true. Next thing I know, he jumps off the train car, which is exactly what a damn suicide sleeper would do. What they call a Isis synchronizer.
Sympathizer. And that's not what he was, Blister.
It's Spyro from now on. Close the fucking door.
Yancey kicked it shut. I hear you're going to be a TV star. That's truly unimaginable. Benny the Blister beamed.
Done deal, man. Ain't you or nobody else gonna screw it up.
And where's the famous Captain Cock? Blister's grin was a pageant of prison dentistry.
You mean my new brother, Buck?
No shit, Yancey said. What a heartwarming turn of events. Brock Richardson had some time to kill before his flight to Key West, so he tried something he hadn't done in years, read a legal document from beginning to end. It was fascinating and harrowing. The document was a deposition from a respected German endocrinologist named Harft, who'd recently completed a 4-year study of a drug called testoferrominol, sold in 19 countries under the trade name Petrolux. The law firm of Truss, Hitch, and Truss, to which Richardson referred many of his telephone clients, had hired Dr. Harft to review the frequency and severity of Petrolux side effects. The findings rocked Richardson to his core. Being, in theory, a plaintiff's lawyer, he was accustomed to grotesquely creative exaggeration in product liability cases. A tiny red bump on the skin became a pernicious and disfiguring rash. Sore joints were automatically presented as excruciating and debilitative. Every headache was a blinding migraine, every bout of constipation a toxic gastrointestinal impactment. And, regardless of anatomical location, each side effect was alleged in every lawsuit to cause a loss of libido and a fear of intimacy that shattered the victim's sexual relationships. However, while studying Dr. Harft's neutral testimony, Richardson realized that for once there was no hype in the charges aimed at the drug's manufacturer. If anything, the printed warnings on the Petrolux bottles underplayed the ghastly possibilities. The lawyer's bizarre experience with the substance wasn't an isolated incident. Numerous male users had reported the appearance of strange skin growths in their armpits, groins, buttocks cracks, and even between their toes. These soft stalks of flesh were typically described as mushroom-like or penile-shaped. Dr. Harft capped his testimony with a discussion of addictive reactions to Petrolux. Some men doubled or even tripled their dosages, even as the unsightly side effects worsened. Richardson could totally relate. When the attorney from Truss Hitch had asked for a professional opinion on what should be done about the deodorant hormone gel, Dr. Harft replied simply, "Remove it from the pharmaceutical marketplace, of course. As you Americans would say, it's really bad scheiße." Richardson placed the deposition in his briefcase and vectored to the nearest bar on the concourse. Before boarding the plane, he removed the travel-sized bottle of Petrolux from his carry-on, intending to throw it away. Then he changed his mind, telling himself it would be careless to discard such a dangerous substance in a public place. What if a child found it in the trash can? In Key West, he was forced to rent a minivan because it was the last vehicle on the lot. He called Deb, who reiterated her opposition to the trip. Richardson replied, "I bet you'd feel different if it was your 200 grand.
"Don't be such a stubborn ass. Just let it go."
"I know what I'm doing."
"Really? Then I've got one more question," Deb said.
"I can hardly wait."
"Cremation or burial? Let me know now, so I can start making arrangements.
Richardson drove to Louis's backyard and waited. Martin Trabeau showed up an hour late with no apology. Richardson was on his third scotch.
I had a girl in my room. She wouldn't leave,
the Sandman explained.
What can I do for you, Counselor? I hope it's not the Cuba trip, because I already filled your slot.
No, it's about my diamond ring, the one your guys were supposed to steal back for me.
The one they couldn't find. Big Noogie told me himself.
Richardson lowered his voice.
Afterward, I sent my guys back to Yancey's place. And guess what? He says your guys took the ring.
And you believe that a-hole?
Trabeau giggled, as if the notion of gangsters pocketing a $200,000 diamond was preposterous.
A man'll say anything when there's pliers attached to his nuts.
That's not how it went down. The bartender interrupted them with a Creole shrimp appetizer that Richardson had ordered earlier. Trabeau admired the spoke-and-wheel design of the crustaceans on crushed ice. When the barman left them alone again, Richardson said,
I want my goddamn rock back, Martin.
Trabeau frowned.
Wish I could help, but I honestly don't see how.
I'll tell you how. Talk to Big Noogie. Tell him how important that ring is to me. Tell him, hell, I don't know, tell him Deb's heart is crushed because she lost it. Make it sound like a sentimental situation.
Are you fucking serious?
Listen, these mafia types, they're romantics deep down. They've all got families and wives and girlfriends, Richardson said. Big Noogie'll understand. Being from the Italian culture, he will totally get where I'm coming from.
Do me a favor. That Google app on your phone? Type in the name Dominic Aiola and tell me if you see the word romantic anywhere on his Wikipedia page. The one that lists all his felony arrests and all the witnesses that mysteriously disappeared.
So you won't talk to him about this?
Under no circumstances, said Trabeau.
It was the answer Richardson expected. Then I'll do it myself. Set up a meeting for me, okay? Trabeau said that was an extremely poor idea. Richardson fidgeted.
What aren't you telling me, Martin?
This is not a man you want to insult. If you accuse him of jacking your diamond, he might take it personally.
What if he doesn't even know? Richardson said. Those two meat hogs he sent to Yancey's, what if they decided to keep the ring and told Big Noogie they couldn't find it?
That would take elephant balls.
But still, you can picture the scenario, right? It's not what you call far-fetched. A crook is a crook.
Trabeau was skeptical.
Seriously, that's your pitch? You're going to tell Big Noogie that his own guys double-crossed him?
I am, and I'm not.
Christ, this isn't a game.
The word thing is what I do best. Trust me, Martin, the reason I write all my own TV commercials? Because I know how to connect with people, all kinds of people. I have the gift of instant empathy.
You cannot fuck this up. This is my business partner we're talking about.
And it's my $200,000 diamond.
Trabeau swiped a shrimp from Richardson's platter.
I can't promise Big Noogie will see you. In fact, I'd be amazed if he does. But I'll ask.
And you'll come with me to the meeting? You don't have to say one word. Just sit there like, you know, the mutual friend.
Not a chance in hell, said the Sandman,
licking a dot of cocktail sauce from his lips.
You go see Big Noogie. You're on your own.
Chapter 22. Buck Nance walked out of a back room glowering at Blister Krill. Yancey noted a scraggly resemblance, close enough to pass themselves off as TV brothers. Both were thin, sallow, and had brown hair shot with gray. Once their beards grew out, they might as well be blood.
Hello, Buck,
Yancey said. Or is it Matthew, like the old times?
Who the hell are you?
He's the one that said he's a cop, but he ain't,
Blister interjected. Buck snorted.
How do you know he's not?
Thank you, said Yancey. Blister turned on the flat screen and told everyone to sit on the couch. He said it was time for Bayou Brethren. Yancey was wedged in the middle, Blister gouging him in the ribcage with the barrel of the handgun. Buck drank Jack Daniels, while Blister popped an IPA called Grizzly Snot. They both quickly got swept up in the TV show, for different reasons. Buck was incensed to learn that Junior was sleeping with Miracle, and that she was now an open topic for all America. Blister's chief concern was his future seating location at the family table. He declared he wanted a chair between Cleroy's wife and Buddy's wife, because they looked hot and doable.
I thought you were married, Buck snapped.
Just common law, which don't even count outside Florida.
But homicide does, Yancey pointed out.
Shut up and watch the damn show,
Blister grumbled. When a commercial came on, he said,
I didn't mean to hurt that little Muslim dude, but for all I knowed, that bag in his hands was a damn suicide bomb.
It was gifts for his family. Yancey looked over at Buck Nance. Souvenirs, Matthew, that's all he was carrying.
Hey, I had nothing to do with it.
Sure you did. Blister idolizes you. Those sermons on YouTube. Blister said,
Amen, brother.
He raised his non-gun hand to quiet the talk, for on television, Buddy Nance had snatched up a half-full Dewar's bottle and heaved it more or less at Junior's head.
Awesome!
Blister cheered at the slow-mo replay. Lane Kuhlman walked in the front door, his face clouding at the sight of Yancey.
There he is, my Hollywood agent,
Blister boomed. Yancey said they'd already met. What are you geniuses up to? He asked Kuhlman. I can't wait to hear the big plan. Blister ordered Yancey to stand, lift his shirt, and show the others where Blister had stabbed him.
In case they think I ain't a serious individual.
The sight of Yancey's sutures properly alarmed Buck and Kuhlman. Blister seemed satisfied. Buck asked Kuhlman for an update on Amp. He's flying in to meet with us, the agent said, as promised.
When?
Soon. Blister said,
Soon ain't fast enough.
Who's Amp? Asked Yancey. Somewhere, Blister came up with boat rope and duct tape. He bound and gagged Yancey before sliding him under a bed. Yancey was impressed by the cleanliness of the floor, not even a dust bunny. The polished pine planks felt cool against his cheek. He shut his eyes and strained to hear the conversation of the carping fuckwits in the adjoining room. Kuhlman was telling Blister it was a really bad move tying up a possible cop. Blister asked if anyone had a better idea. Buck said he couldn't wait to get the fuck out of Florida. Yancey rolled from beneath the bed, thinking it was a good thing that Rosa couldn't see him now. He struggled to his feet and tumbled himself through an open window, his fall cushioned by a row of lush greenery. Once upright, he advanced pogo-style to the nearest cottage, where he used his forehead to bang on the door. The woman who answered was the blonde model from the vodka commercial being filmed on the beach. Yancey blinked and grunted beseechingly. Miraculously, the woman let him hop inside, where he toppled sideways onto a divan. After she peeled the tape from his mouth, he said, You have the golden heart of an angel.
Dude, who did this to you? I'm going to call the cops.
Her name was Miso, and she couldn't find her phone. Yancey asked her to get a knife and cut the ropes from his wrists and ankles. She hurried to the kitchen, but returned empty-handed, saying,
Sorry, but I'm really stoned.
Please go look again.
I like you. What's your deal?
Any sharp object will do the job, Yancey said.
I don't know. Maybe you're a serial killer.
This would be an odd way to stalk my victims.
That's true.
Miso shrugged.
Look, I was supposed to meet up with some people, you know, from the crew.
Yancey said, I really need your help. She went back to the kitchen, returned with a steak knife, and commenced sawing on the ropes. Because of her loopy condition, Yancey feared for his veins and arteries. The sash on her robe came undone, presenting a caramel flash of skin that distracted him from her blade work. Once freed, he positioned himself by a window with an unimpeded view of the cottage occupied by Blister and the others. Yancey lowered and cracked the blinds. Miso sat beside him. He told her she'd looked great on the set of the vodka commercial.
I totally don't even drink that crap, she said. What is a guava, anyway?
You're on your way to something bigger. That's all that matters, your life trajectory.
Dude, I'm 21 and a half.
Hang in there, Yancey said.
What's your story? Why don't you call the cops on those assholes?
I left my phone in the car. Also, I am a cop.
You are not.
She laughed and frogged his arm.
I said I was stoned, not stupid.
Respect, por favor. I used to be a hotshot police detective, for real. Now I'm just a humble, hardworking health inspector.
Yeah, right. I totally know what you inspect.
I'm Andrew, by the way, Andrew Yancey. I'd show you my ID, except...
It's in the car with your phone, right? I'm so sure.
Yancey smiled. She smelled like pot and coconut butter. You, who are so quick to judge, he said, let me point out that miso is a Japanese soup.
It's just plain old Jane on my driver's license.
A perfectly lovely name.
Not for modeling, it isn't, she said. You want a drink? If I can even find the damn liquor. I totally smoked the last dube, so don't ask.
Yancey put a finger to his lips as he parted the blinds.
Take a look, he whispered.
Benny Krill, Buck Nance, and Lane Coolman had emerged from the nearby cottage. They stood conferring on the porch in no discernible state of panic, which meant they were unaware Yancey had escaped from the bedroom.
Those three fellows, he said to Miso, aren't exactly master criminals.
Yeah, I get that, Andrew. Why'd they tie you up?
I'll tell you everything later. Would you mind getting dressed?
Where are we going? Are jeans okay?
Jeans are excellent. She stood up and shed the robe, saying,
This is crazy. What am I doing?
You'll have a good story to tell your friends.
Promise?
Totally, said Yancey. Vance Banks stood on the slender balcony of his apartment, wishing he had a view of Biscayne Bay instead of the Miami Beach Public Works garage. He wore a hurricane's hoodie and dark glasses to hide his face, an act of prudence, not paranoia. Vance Banks was only 31, but he'd accumulated more enemies than most men twice his age. This was the result of failing to repay certain debts associated with a roaring appetite for cocaine, gambling, and high-end escorts. One such obligation had, in only a few brief weeks, mushroomed with interest from $6,000 to $22,500, a sum currently unavailable to Vance Banks. Being not entirely dim-witted, he understood that the men from whom he had borrowed the $6,000 were more humorless and violent than any of his other creditors. His divorced sister in Jacksonville was unsympathetic, Vance Banks having tooted away a sizable inheritance. His brother in Gulf Shores had long ago stopped returning his calls, while his mother communicated seldom and only through attorneys. Having few options, Vance Banks accepted the fact that, once again, it was time to leave town. So, late that night, he vacated his apartment, placed his gray tabby cat in the car, drove across the MacArthur Causeway, and moved in with his cocaine dealer in Coral Gables. The men to whom Vance Banks owed $22,500 had never seen such a lazy attempt at evasion. They felt insulted. In return for providing Vance Banks a place to crash, the coke dealer asked him to drive a 2008 Toyota Camry from the port of Miami to a motel in Hialeah. Vance Banks had no experience on the supply side of drug transactions, but the coke dealer assured him that none would be needed for this job. If he'd known that Vance Banks was in debt to the Calzone crime family, he would not have handed him the keys to that particular vehicle. The instructions given to Vance Banks were simple. Obey the speed limits, observe all traffic signals, and do not open the trunk of the vehicle unless ordered to by a uniformed police officer. Leaving nothing to chance, or so he thought, the coke dealer selected on MapQuest the simplest route of travel and placed a printout in the hands of Vance Banks. Upon arriving at the motel, Vance Banks would simply back the Camry into a parking spot and walk away. There would be no verbal or visual contact with the individuals awaiting the delivery. Vance Banks hoped to be well paid for this risky chore, but that didn't happen. He never made it to the motel. On Northwest 62nd Street, only 5 blocks off the interstate, the Camry was struck from behind by an old black pickup that had been following him unnoticed since he'd left his cocaine dealer's apartment. The crash didn't injure Vance Banks or his cat Sawyer, which he'd brought along to calm his nerves. With Sawyer safe in his arms, he got out of the Camry and observed with dismay that the impact of the accident had sprung the trunk lid. Frantically, Vance Banks tried to close it, but the crumpling was too severe. Upon approaching the pickup truck, he saw behind the wheel a red-haired woman in a tan, low-cut sweater. When she rolled down the window, he became aware of a disposable razor in her right hand. A dark skirt was bunched around her waist, and there was no outline of panties. The driver's long, creamy legs led to feet adorned by gem-encrusted flip-flops.
"Super-duper sorry," she said.
"Are you seriously shaving your
bikini zone? It's worse than texting, I know. Completely took my eyes off the road."
"Freak city," muttered Vance Banks, nervously eyeing the passing traffic.
The woman tossed the razor and lowered her skirt.
"I was on my way to Rocky's. That's my boyfriend. He likes a smooth landing zone, if you know what I mean. Your kitty's quite handsome, by the way. He's got what they call a noble countenance. What's his name?"
"Sawyer, and it's a she."
"I'm Mary," the woman said. "Spelled like Merry Christmas."
She held her hand out the window so Vance Banks could shake it.
"Honest, I'll pay to fix your car."
"It doesn't belong to me, unfortunately."
"Well, let's have a look-see at the damage."
She reached to unbuckle her seatbelt.
"No," Vance Banks blurted. "Stay right there."
The red-haired woman wore a sexy perfume, which further diminished the chances of Vance Banks making a wise decision. What he should have done was get the hell out of there before a cop drove up. But a pleasant sort of paralysis had set in. She said,
"Now my dumb truck won't even start. I've got some cash at home if you'll give me a ride. That way we don't have to call the police or insurance company. Please?"
"I guess, sure."
He
He figured he could use a shoelace to tie down the trunk lid of the Camry.
How far away is your place?
Oh, just a few blocks.
You should text your boyfriend and tell him you'll be late.
She smiled.
You think he doesn't trust me? You're right.
My name's Vance Banks.
The woman reacted with wide eyes.
Dude, are you feeling okay? Did you hit your head in the accident?
What makes you say that?
Because you gave me your real name, she said. Most guys lie.
Wait, what? Do you know me?
Poor baby, she said.
A white Lincoln coupe rolled up and a stocky, well-dressed man got out. He had an ivory toothpick in his mouth and a small silver revolver in one hand. Vance Banks said, with belated perception, I am so fucked.
My suggestion? Give them whatever they want.
But I don't have their money. I'm tapped out.
Get creative, the redhead said. Come on, Vance, step it up.
She offered to take care of his cat, but the transfer was vetoed by the man with the toothpick. Within moments, the Lincoln departed at high speed, carrying Vance Banks, the purring Sawyer, and a gym bag holding 48 one-ounce bags of premium cocaine that had been removed from the Camry's trunk. Mary Mansfield abandoned the black pickup on 62nd Street and Ubered back to her hotel on the beachside. She did 40 minutes on the treadmill, took a shower, and then sat down with a book called Treasures of the Spanish Main, which she'd checked out of the library on Alton Road. At 6:30, she put on blue jean overalls and clogs. Her hair was still wet, so she opted for pigtails. A yellow cab dropped her at the News Cafe, where the man with the ivory toothpick was already waiting. When Mary sat down at the table, he passed her an envelope containing 11 $100 bills, more than she expected.
You did real good. That's how come there's extra, the man said. The dope in the car was a bonus.
So you and I can talk direct from now on, right? No more Zitos in between.
Jesus, what a retard. He really fried himself to death with a Prius?
It was a Tesla, Mary said.
Is the voltage higher on them?
That's a darn good question.
The man took a drink of coffee, the toothpick still lolling in his mouth.
He said, Swear to God, long as I've been in this business, it still blows my fucking mind.
The stupidity, you mean?
You never been to prison. But let me tell you this for a fact. Every new generation of these shitheads is dumber than the last. It's harder and harder to find good people.
Mary pushed the envelope full of cash back across the table and said,
The job I did today is free if you promise not to hurt the cat.
The man with the toothpick chuckled.
Keep it, babe. One call to mama and Mr. Banks came up with our money. Really, it was more like 8-9 calls. Point is, he got to keep his kitty and his nuts. You up for another gig?
Depends on when and where.
Boca, tomorrow afternoon. West Boca, actually. The guy's a major pussy hound, so it should go easy. He drives a gray Audi. I'll text you the tag.
Mary said,
Not tomorrow. I'm going out of town.
What for?
Friend of mine down in the Keys. It's a long story. He's in over his head.
The man with the toothpick said,
Can't he wait a day, this friend?
Mary shook her head.
I've got a feeling he can't.
The three men walked across US 1 to a restaurant called Morada Bay. They took a table outside, supposedly to watch the sunset. Benny the Blister announced he'd changed his mind. He no longer wished to be called Spyro when he joined the cast of Bayou Brethren.
I come up with something way better, he said. Deer Bone.
Deer Bone. Deer Bone Nance.
Kuhlman repeated it several times.
I think I'm loving it.
Buck said,
What does it even mean?
besides that deers have bones.
Listlessly, he stared out at the mangrove islands. Kuhlman could tell he was thinking about his ex-mistress, Miracle, grinding on his brother.
"Make sure it's fixed in the legal papers," Blister went on. "Call your damn boss and tell him Spyro's out, deer bones in."
"Great name, bro. Authentic," Kuhlman said. He didn't care what the cocksucker called himself when he got to jail, which is where he was going as soon as they nailed down the deal memo for Buck's contract. Kuhlman had stored on his phone the number of the local Crime Stoppers hotline. A more immediate worry for Kuhlman was Inspector Yancey, hogtied under a bed in the bungalow. Conspiring in an abduction was not in the Platinum Artist's agent's playbook. Even if Yancey wasn't a cop, he probably had cop connections. Kuhlman decided to offer him some money to forget about what happened. The payoff could be layered into Buck Nance's deal as a one-time consultant's fee. Blister continued yammering throughout dinner, while Buck spoke barely a word and snubbed his broiled lobster. Kuhlman finally said, "Look, I had nothing to do with Miracle switching to Junior. That wasn't my call."
"So it was Amp."
"The bitch was pissed off at you, dude. Vengeance-wise, she had worse things in mind, trust me. This was a compromise."
"What about the condo? I want her out of my goddamn condo."
Blister piped,
"Hell, I'll take it. Is there a hot tub?"
"Jacuzzi," said Buck through clenched teeth.
"What's the motherfucking difference? I'm gonna hang a big-ass rebel flag and blast Molly Hatchet all night long."
The Pensacola condominium was titled in Miracle's name, and there was already a Confederate flag on the bathroom wall.
"Legally, she owns the place," Kuhlman said to Buck. "That's how you wanted it, remember?"
Buck slammed a fist on the table, which was so heavy it barely moved. Tears pooled in his eyes as he nursed his throbbing hand. Blister was sympathetic.
"You was blinded by the pussy, that's all. I've been there, brother. Say hi to pussy, say bye-bye to common sense."
"Just shut up," Buck groaned.
A pair of ibises landed nearby and began walking the beach side by side, probing here and there with their curled beaks. Kuhlman wondered why he and Rachel could never get in sync like that. Blister was now babbling about the iconic significance of the stars and bars, how the proud white race shouldn't let those damn northern faggots and communist Negroes tear down that sacred old flag. Having minored in American history at UC Davis, Kuhlman was tempted to pop a Civil War quiz on Mr. Krill. The moron probably didn't know Manassas from Manitoba. However, since the moron had a loaded gun and no sense of irony, Kuhlman kept quiet. As a manager of so-called talent, he was demoralized to find himself in such low company, sitting between an armed crackpot and a fake chicken farmer known to millions as Captain Cock. Back home in Beverly Hills, rival agents were dining with classy A-listers like Javier Bardem and the Coen brothers, or so Kuhlman bitterly imagined.
"If I ice this deal," he thought, "I should start my own agency."
After sunset, the three men walked next door to Pierre's and took seats at the elegant wooden bar. Kuhlman began feeling more positive about his professional situation. At one end of the room, a curly-headed guitarist played killer flamenco, applauded by a couple sitting together behind a potted palm. A tall brunette, who had mistakenly dressed for St. Bart's, emerged from a thrumming cluster of women and approached Buck Nance. She handed him a cocktail napkin and asked for an autograph, which he signed Jerry Jeff Walker. Her request for a selfie was denied, but still she was beaming as she rejoined her friends. When Blister called out for a Pabst, the bartender looked at him as if he were speaking Togolese. Kuhlman ordered Jack and Waters for all of them.
Where are we meeting, Amp? Buck asked, the Cajun accent still exiled. Blister said,
Someplace safe. Those fucking Key West cops are still looking for me.
Kuhlman put a hand on his shoulder. No worries, dear bone. I've got this. Blister smiled at the sound of his new name. Buck sullenly scratched at the thickening stubble on his chin. The bartender came over and said,
That gentleman back in the corner says you boys owe him a drink.
Kuhlman worriedly scanned the room.
What gentleman?
The tan dude with the hot blonde. They're sitting near the guitar player.
Andrew Yancey rose and parted the fronds of the potted palm so that the men at the bar could see his face.
You gotta be shitting me, Blister said. I'm gonna kick that mother's ass.
Buck Nance muttered,
Nice job on those knots, dear brain.
Yancey saluted the trio with an erect middle digit raised high.
What's he drinking?
Lane Kuhlman asked the bartender.
Get one for the girl, too.
Chapter 23 Martin Trabeau told Juveline he was meeting Big Noogie at Higgs Beach.
Just don't show him your prize jewels, she said.
They were in the bathtub, Juveline soaking on her back. Trabeau was curled like a comma on top of her, his head pillowed by her breasts. There was water all over the floor. Gentle scrubbing had failed to remove the kiss-blowing emojis from his testicles.
Are you positively positive he doesn't know about us?
Trabeau asked. Juveline flicked his soapy earlobe.
The Noog don't have a clue. You must think I'm dumber than a mud fence. Is that what you think?
What about the hickey?
I told him it was a love nip from John.
The dog? And he believed that?
Course he did. I could make you believe it, too.
The Sandman climbed out of the tub.
Where are you supposed to be right now?
I don't know. Shopping.
Then that's where you need to be.
I already bought 2 new hats for Havana, she said, and panties with little green parrots all over, but you're not allowed to see them till we get there.
Sweetie, I can't wait.
The weather had warmed, so Higgs Beach was crowded. Trabeau searched a while before he located Big Noogie, enthroned under a rainbow-striped umbrella with John the First. Exuberantly, the setter began sniffing Trabeau, who backed off in fear that his clothes bore incriminating scents. Big Noogie said,
Juveline lets him sleep in the same bed as us. You believe that? Dog hairs all over the goddamn duvet.
Trabeau couldn't change the subject fast enough.
Great news, he said. Cuba approved my visa. You set up that meeting with your connection? The deputy minister's very pragmatic for a socialist. I wish you could come with me.
Trabeau held his breath, praying that the federal judge who had confiscated Big Noogie's passport hadn't suddenly changed his mind.
Another time, said the mobster.
Having never seen the second Godfather, he knew next to nothing about Havana. Scooping a handful of sand, he asked,
Is the shit over there as good as this?
Way better, Trabeau smiled.
And it's pink, Dominic.
No fucking way.
The beach of Playa Ramera, you bet your ass. Miles and miles of it.
You mean pink like...
Oh, yeah.
Trabeau offered a knuckle bump that went unreciprocated. Big Noogie was watching the grains drizzle through his fingers.
Your oceanfront hotels here in the States, your 4-star properties,
he mused.
They'd pay a goddamn fortune for pink.
We're gonna kill it, Dominic. Kill it.
2 lanky young women walked up and asked if they could pet Big Noogie's service dog. John the First rolled over, reveling in the sweet-smelling attention. The women said they were visiting Key West on spring break with their college sorority.
They said they were playing a volleyball match with some off-duty firefighters. From the way the women looked at him, Trabeau sensed they were trying to figure out whether it was he or Big Noogie that needed a special canine companion. The women said they attended Washington and Lee, which sounded like a serious school.
"What do you think of this beach?"
Big Noogie asked.
"On a scale of, like, 1 to 10.
11,
the women answered together, laughing.
"Okay, what if the sand was pink?"
"Bullshit," one of them said. "Pink sand? I'd give that a 15,
the other one chortled.
"No, 20.
They hugged John the First and called out goodbye as they scampered back to their sorority gathering. Trabeau clapped and said,
"This Cuba deal's gonna be mega, mega. We ought to change the company name to Global Sedimental Journeys." "I think those two girls were tanked."
"Who cares, Dominic? We don't need a damn focus group to tell us Pink Beach is kick-ass."
Big Noogie opened a sports canteen and poured some water into a plastic bowl. He placed it in front of the fake service dog, which commenced slurping like a horse.
"When are you going back north?"
Trabeau asked with a nonchalant lilt.
"Why do you give a shit? I like it here. Today is 47 fucking degrees back home."
Big Noogie flapped his flimsy tank top to demonstrate how comfortable he felt in South Florida.
"Now, what's this other favor you want from me? The first being not feeding your ass to the hammerheads."
"It's nothing, really. No pressure."
"Do I look fucking pressured?"
"So it's the dude whose girl lost that big diamond ring, the Miami lawyer. He wants a sit-down to talk about what happened when your guys went to his crazy neighbor's house."
"I told you what happened. My guys didn't find no rock."
"He's got a theory. What can I say?"
"A theory? That's rich."
"More like a scenario," the Sandman said. "Listen, Dominic, you don't need to bother with this. I'll tell him you're too busy to meet. End of story. What's he gonna do?"
Grunting like a hog in quicksand, Big Noogie dragged himself from the shade of the beach umbrella into the sunlight. He rose up, squinting behind his sunglasses and brushing off the seat of his tent-sized board shorts.
"Now you got me curious,"
he said to Trabeau.
"Go on. Set it up."
"Seriously? Just you and him?"
"Tell me again the name of this douche."
"Brock Richardson."
"The one on TV does all the dick deodorant cases. I seen his commercials."
Trabeau said, "You don't put the stuff on your dick. It goes under your arms."
"How the fuck does that get you hard?"
"I have no clue, Dominic, but from what I hear, that shit will definitely mess you up."
"Tell the lawyer to come tomorrow morning. 10 sharp, same place."
John the First started barking at a trio of tourists hanging from a fluorescent parachute being towed by a speedboat offshore. Big Noogie stepped on the setter's leash to prevent another manic breakaway.
"That's a sharp vest he's got," the Sandman remarked. "How much?"
$29 off Amazon."
"Did I not tell you it was easy?"
"It's still a scum move. Only reason I did it, Juveline didn't want her little buddy catching pneumonia down in Cargo. She wants him sitting on the plane with us."
"Hey, that doggy vest also got you onto this beach. It says right there that only service animals are allowed."
Trabeau pointed at the sign.
"You should thank me."
Big Noogie closed the rainbow umbrella and tucked it under one arm.
"Be that as it may," he said, "John and me are going to go watch a volleyball game."
Rosa emailed a photo of herself carving a reindeer shank at the butcher shop in Oslo. A few minutes later, Mary Mansfield sent a picture of a gold earwax spoon recovered from the wreck of the Santa Margarita, a treasure-laden galleon that sank off the Marquesas during a hurricane in 1622. Yancey wasn't sure how to respond to either of the women, so he didn't. He was back in Key West, parked at the cemetery, waiting for Irv Clippy Klapowski. The restaurant owner had made him promise to come alone. Yancey sent him a text. "Could you pick a creepier place to meet?"
"Be there in 15, Clippy texted back.
In the meantime, Miso, the vodka model, called to thank Yancey for a fun time the night before. She'd been a very good sport. Yancey had given her contact info to Lane Kuhlman, Buck Nance's manager, during an impromptu meeting on the porch at Pierre's. Miso had remained inside at the wooden bar, expertly mesmerizing Buck Nance and Benny the Blister. Outside, Kuhlman was offering Yancey $75,000 to forget Blister had pointed a loaded firearm at his head, tied him up, and shoved him under a bed. When Yancey had turned down the payoff, Kuhlman got aggravated.
"Then what the hell do you want from us?"
"I want Benny Krill," Yancey had replied, "soon as you're done with him."
"Are you going to kill him? Because here's the thing, we prefer him to be in jail, not deceased. The storyline we have in mind, jail would work better."
"That's where he'll be."
"And we can be assured of that, how?" Kuhlman had said.
"Because I keep my word, which I realize is freak behavior where you come from."
"Why don't you just take the damn money? We'll do the wire transfer first thing tomorrow."
"I'm not going away," Yancey had said. "When you guys finish with Blister, call me, not Crime Stoppers. If that's not how it goes down, meaning he ends up somewhere other than my custody, I'll be submitting a sordidly detailed affidavit describing what you and your deranged clients did to me inside that cottage at the moorings, the whippings and fondling and so forth."
"Oh, come on!"
"I don't think you appreciate my ragged state of mind."
"Fine, whatever, we'll give you Krill."
"When?"
2 days, 3 tops,
Kuhlman had said. "Here's my phone number.
One more thing." "Jesus, I fucking knew it."
"My beautiful companion at the bar, she wants to be an actress."
"Imagine that."
"Find her some work," Yancey had said. His state of mind was, in fact, not good. Watching Bayou Brethren in the company of Buck Nance and Blister had been a setback, morale-wise. Yancey might have found humor in the bourbon-soaked TV version of rural Southern life if Buck was just another harmless stooge. But he wasn't. He was a septic inspiration to impressionable mouth-breathers such as Benny the Blister, who had accosted an innocent Muslim man only because he imagined that's what his hero, Captain Cock, would have done. Yancey looked forward to handing over Blister Krill to Sheriff Sonny Summers, though he knew the Conk Train case was weak due to the conflicting witness accounts. The odds were at least 50-50 that Blister would get acquitted, leaving unpunished the death of Abdul Halim Shamoon. As for the stalker-style kidnapping of Buck Nance and his manager, Kuhlman had informed Yancey that neither he nor his star client planned to cooperate with prosecutors. Once Buck returned to the Brethren, there would be no window in his hectic shooting schedule for a lengthy and embarrassing trial. Even if delivering Blister to the sheriff got Yancey reinstated, it would be sickening to see the man walk free later. Yancey felt sick now, thinking about it. The best hope for sending that crazy dirtbag back to prison was to prosecute him for the stabbing. As the victim, Yancey would be compelled to take the witness stand, where his character would receive a battering by Blister's defense lawyer. There was rich material to work with. Rosa emailed Yancey another picture, snow flurries, bare trees, and glowing street lamps. It made Yancey want to drive home, gas up his boat, and go fishing in the sunshine. But first, here was Clippy, arriving in a dingy truck that belonged to a carpet company. He pulled up next to Yancey's Subaru, lowered a window, and said,
I put in a good word for you at Sonny's fundraiser, Andrew. Just so you're aware, Neil and I forked out the max for his campaign, meaning we had his full, undivided attention when I told him he should hire you back on the force. I said you were a solid guy, a brilliant detective.
I sincerely appreciate that. Thank you.
Happy to do what I can. Happy to help.
Clippy, why are you driving that truck?
You'll see.
And why are we here at the graveyard?
Get in, Andrew. Please?
Stacked behind the front seats of the truck were rolls of Berber carpet and foam padding. Yancey heard something move and wondered if a person was tied up in the back. Perhaps Clippy and Neil were having a falling out.
I know I can trust you, Clippy said. Right?
He drove without elaboration to the landfill on Stock Island. The porcelain sky was full of buzzards and seagulls. A sickly tang rose from the steep hill of garbage, where Yancey and Rogelio Burton once spent 7 wretched hours searching for a carrot peeler that had been used as a murder weapon. They never found it, but the experience bonded the two for life. At the top of the mound lay the ripest waste, bagged and unbagged, awaiting the county backhoes. On windy afternoons, you could almost breathe without covering your face, but today there was no breeze off the gulf. The smell was awful, even with the truck windows rolled up.
Oh, dear God Almighty, gasped Clippy, pinching the bridge of his nose.
Please tell me we're not here to bury the mayor,